Before we get started, a quick disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear is an offer or a solicitation to buy or sell any investment. With that, hello, welcome to the Rangeley Capital Podcast. I'm Chris DeMuth, a PM at Rangeley. And with me, as always, is my co-host and colleague, Andrew Walker, who is a fellow PM at Rangeley as well. Today, we discuss GM and Prince. To start with, GM, possibly the more serious, weighty topic, General Motors has recently been getting activist pressure from investor Greenlight Capital, run by billionaire David Einhorn. You know, if you have $900 million, you're just a guy, maybe a kind of rich guy. But once you cross that number, then you're like, it's the American equivalent of being Sir or having a title. You're always billionaire David Einhorn. It'd be very, very demoralizing to lose that in the process.
The Silicon Valley, the comedy on HBO, There's this great scene where they've got these crazy venture capitalists, and there's this guy, and he's like, I'm a member of the Three Comma Club, because he's a billionaire. And then one of his investments goes bankrupt or something, and he goes down to $950 million, and he freaks out. He's like, you guys have to sell for a premium. I need to get my third comma back.
And in terms of personal consumption, it really, I mean, you can't buy an aircraft carrier, but other than that, you really can fly private. There's nothing much after that, but ego, and there's probably plenty of that. In any event, he only owns less than 1% of the stock, but he... Came up with a plan. Andrew, what do you think of his plan?
Look, he owns less than 1% of the stock, but it's 10% of his portfolio. So, yeah. You know, it's tough. Sometimes you'll see activists saying something. You'd be like, I'll do this too. I'll be like, oh, they only own 2% of the company. But if it's that big of a piece of your portfolio, you clearly have every incentive to see the company do well and do what's in the best interest of the company.
Sure. You might just be right. I mean, it's a pair of fresh eyes, and you might just be right.
Now, his proposal here is to split the company stock into two stock, mm-hmm. what he's calling the dividend stock and the share appreciation stock. And he argues by doing that, the company's... The total value of that would be worth $50 per share versus I think it's around $35 today. I get what he's saying, but look, to me, this is the example of financial engineering. 3-4 years ago, he proposed this for Apple. He was proposing they issue what he was cheekily calling iPrefs. And to me, this is financial engineering kind of at its worst. You know, if he thinks the shares are undervalued, he should be pushing the company to buy back shares, which would increase value for all remaining shareholders instead of this kind of one-time pop by playing this financial gimmickry. But, you know, I can understand where he's coming from.
You know, I think that in both cases, he kind of had a fallback plan. I would associate myself with everything you said. I think that it was a gimmick, but it's also a revealing gimmick. And by that, I mean, maybe they would accept his plan, but even short of accepting it, laying out the value, just even as a mental exercise, if what he said is true, maybe you should own the stock today. Maybe that could help their market valuation. He emphasized, he said GM's trading at 5.6 times PE, not normally a metric that I overly fixate on, but it's more useful at the extremes. And this one is extremely low, at least the lowest in the S&P 500. And my thought, though, is I question philosophically whether it's GM's job to, as he said, reveal the value. I think it's GM's job certainly to build cars. It's GM's job absolutely long-term to enrich owners. But I've always thought that being underestimated is a wonderful thing. Some of the managements that are best at creating value for owners are terrible, and in some cases intentionally terrible at revealing that value.
Well, so I see what you're saying there, but at the same time, like if your stock is worth 50 and you're trading for 35, then every capital allocation decision you're making has to be weighed against buying back your shares at 35.
Yes.
So I would argue if they're not buying back money hand over fist, like they're being suboptimal if their stock's really worth 50. I do think it's interesting, you know, I've seen even Warren Buffett owns GM now, or I think it's one of his lieutenants who's actually bought it, but even Berkshire owns GM, and everybody fixates on this 5.6 P number. And it's interesting to me for two reasons. A auto manufacturer is just a pile of leverage. So these things, they look very cheap on a price to earnings metric, but if you went and look at them at kind of, you back out all the pension expenses, you back out all the debt and everything, they start to look less cheap. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you know, you generally look at a PE ratio, not absolute, but relative.
Yeah.
And in that case, GM is right in line with where Ford, with Volkswagen, Fiat, where all of these guys are trading on every metric. They're all pretty similar. And what's interesting to me is everyone has fixated on GM. You know, Einhorn, Buffett, a lot of other value investors have fixated on GM. And it's interesting to me they do that because if I look across the spectrum, Ford is controlled by the Ford family. They own a special class of voting shares. Fiat's controlled. Volkswagen's controlled. The French manufacturers, the French government effectively controls them. GM's really the only game in town
yep.
for people who want to push this type of financial engineering. So it's interesting to me that all of them, you know, clearly all of them are attracted to the auto sector, which is, it's cyclical, it's got a lot of leverage, and they're clearly attracted to the low valuations with that cyclicality, but they're going after the only target they can kind of influence.
It is the nail with all these guys holding a hammer, and cultural government control shares prevent any other nails from being hit. So they'll kind of every once in a while look at GM and say, oh, I'll hit that. You know, my thought on this plan, I didn't think it was crazy. I don't think I would have necessarily supported it, and GM did not. But I thought also that if this, let's just stipulate that this value could be realized or it could be revealed that mm-hmm. the value is there. But it's the kind of thing that a broker, which every day they engage in financial engineering, it's not the same epithet that it is with a car company, they could just create a derivative. They could just have a synthetic offering that would be very easy for them to hedge, where you could own the dividends of GM and I could own the growth.
Before, I used to work at a private bank, and a lot of them will do for high net worth clients. They'll do exactly what mm-hmm. you're saying. And basically all they do, look, they buy the stock and they'll sell a call against it, right? Yeah. And if you buy a stock and sell a call, you can kind of create your own dividend by capping out the call. So they do that, and that's a great way for them to get commissions while kind of pitching their clients on something interesting. I want to turn back to the valuation. You know, the one thing I think is interesting is if you look at the valuation, car companies are cyclical. Right now, we're selling about 15 million light autos right now. So we're kind of not on the high end of the peak and the crisis. It went below 10, but 15 million is kind of bumping up against where the cycle's starting to get a little hot. I think it is interesting to think, like, you know, with ride sharing and self-driving cars coming, you know, no one can say Uber's not taking a lot of share. Are people less likely to buy cars going forward? Will there be lower auto sales going forward? And if that's the case, yes, GM's valued at 6x today's trailing PE. But if you look forward 2 years and think, oh, we're going to sell 20% less cars because 20% fewer people will own cars because ride sharing takes a lot of cars and less people need to own a car. You know, that 6x PE with 20% less sales, it starts to look an awful lot like 15 or 18x. And that's before you start thinking about Tesla and electric cars, self-driving automobiles and all that. So I agree, it looks cheap. There's a lot of leverage, so you could do really well if things work out here. But I think there's a lot of risk in the auto sector right now. Though, you know, they're clearly a friend of Donald Trump and he wants to encourage them. He might give them some tax breaks and things that could make things interesting as well.
Einhorn did very much in his letter emphasize this as a Trump presidency stock. Mm-hmm. It is a low multiple, tax-paying company. But culturally, boy, things are changing. You have those technological alternatives that you mentioned, and just the cultural reality that's so, so different than a few decades ago, where it was commonplace up and down the socioeconomic ladder, not just relegated to middle class or wealthy people,
yeah.
that you'd buy a car. And now I find more and more quirks of the opposite. You know, I remember a lot of, you know, kids in scholarship with no money who would figure out some way to buy a clunker, very culturally
yep.
relevant. And today I see much more of the example of professional people who could easily afford it, who just don't own cars, and it doesn't occur to them that they don't have a car because it's so convenient to not have one.
Exactly. You know, a car, I don't want to talk too much more about it, but it's a wasted asset for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. It goes unused 98% of the time. You pay a lot of money for it. It costs a lot of money. Why not just call up an Uber? And they've got these great stats that even if you're using Uber 4 or 5 times a day, if you compare it to the all-in cost of owning a car, like, a lot of times you're much better off just using an Uber or ride-sharing service.
Ready to move on to Prince?
I feel like Uber should be sponsoring us if we're going to be just throwing them like great praise like that on the podcast, saying, take an Uber over buy GM stock. I think that needs to be sponsored. Uber, where are you?
Some people don't take money under or over the table for some highfalutin principled reason. They haven't, my hand is outstretched.
I don't know how many times we can tell people our hand is under the table for this podcast, waiting for some cash to come here, and we just are not getting cash under the table, and I just can't understand how much clearer we can make it.
We are capitalists. Going on to Prince, Prince is still dead. He was a successful singer, a musician. He was throughout his life a skeptic of his industry and a bit of an odd duck. I mean, he stacked up $1 million worth of gold bars. He collected real estate. He did a lot of things on his own. He did it pretty successfully. He ended up at the end of his life with estate worth in excess of $200 million. He did not have a lot of the sort of sophisticated financial connections that you normally would in that circumstance. And he kind of had a local bank that he had done some business with, but really didn't know what to do. And so without any will, PSA, if you have over $200 million, in fact, if you have over $2 million, write a will. But he was put in the clutches of a kind of industry entertainment lawyer who dealt with it. So, Andrew, what caught your eye about this? What happened next?
So, I think the story was an industry entertainment lawyer ran the auction for the rights to his music.
Yep.
And Universal won it for $60 million. And Sony and I can't remember who the other big music group is. Sony and they're escaping me. But they complained, hey, we would have paid way more than $60
million. Access Industries.
Yeah, we would have paid way more than $60 million. We were kind of shut out of this process. So I think that's kind of where we wanted to take the podcast. You know, I think it's awful. We've seen a lot of times in these bankruptcy cases, look, this is why they can be so attractive for investors, because in these bankruptcy cases, value can be lost and found, and it's a very inefficient market where if you've got the right legal teams, you can find value, you can get good deals. In this case, Universal, for some unknown reason to me, managed to strike a relationship and got what looks like it's going to be a great deal. You know, if other people are willing to pay $70 million, 65, 70, 75, and you get it for 60, in general, you probably did pretty well.
You know, if you have a open, full process, the information's available from the people who are reasonably likely to be the bidders. You want this information to them. You want them to all get the very best. And, you know, for other things we look at, we kind of have a little bit of an ear for this. And boy, there were a lot of very curious things about this process.
And like, this is one thing you and I with management companies and companies when they're in processes and things, we say like, listen, in this article, the guy says, look, it wasn't all about the money.
It was not about the money.
It was about the size, the scope. And this is something we're pushing on companies. Like, listen, we are shareholders. Like, your duty to us is, it is all about the money. You need to find a deal. Now you can weigh like, hey, if somebody offers us $12 and somebody else offers us $13, but the $12 is much more likely, you can risk adjust, but you need to go out to all bidders and say, hey, give me the highest offer. We don't care if the offer is coming from somebody who's willing to pay in pounds versus euros. Like, get us the highest dollar amount. We'll worry about the conversion. Get us the best deal. Scour the ends of the earth to find the best deal. And in this case, he clearly did not, and that results in a great deal for Universal.
Absolutely. When Mr. McMillan said, it's not all about the money, I thought, whenever somebody says that, it's all about the money. He said that he weighed factors such as the company's size, scope, expertise, copyright management ability, and executives. And I thought, and that was his conclusion on why he rejected Sony and Warner.
Sony, which is either the first or second largest music company in the world. Like, of course they could do all this. And you know what's interesting to me? So I think he did this. I think he rejected all this because the other people wanted to buy the... He mentions in the thing, oh, everyone else wanted to buy the rights and Universal was willing to license and we were only looking to license deal. So it seems that's why he did it, because I think a license deal might have let him like keep his job longer or something. But man, he was... If you do the math in this article, he gets a 5% commission on anything that was paid. And it sounds like Sony and the other bidders were willing to go above $65 million. Universal one was $60 million. Do 5%, just call the difference $5 million. 5% on that is $250,000. Like, how much is he getting paid to manage this estate for the license deal that he'd rather have his job and manage that licensing contract than get 5% and the $250,000 upfront commission? Like, woof, these things are expensive.
Yeah, no, I think he wanted all of it or as much of it as he could get. His excuse was so curiously worded. He said the other bidder for the merchandise rights, they wanted to buy rather than license, which wasn't an option the state was considering. But I read that a couple times, and that's completely circular. He is the estate. He's representing the estate.
Yeah.
And he just rejected them out of hand for that, just to keep his work.
Though, I will say, because I'm kind of remembering the Prince's thing, and if I remember correctly, there was a big thing when Prince died that he didn't license any of his rights. He didn't license any of his rights, but in this case, everybody else wanted to buy versus license, so it seems like that would have been in line. I don't know.
Well, the whole point of money is you have this medium, so you don't have to judge the counterparty's intent. When they're buying with cash, you take the high bidder. I think he was trying to sort of do what Prince did in his lifetime, but if Prince had strong feelings about this for after his lifetime, then he should have written it down in the will. The assets, the estate, and all of our resources are for the living. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not for the dead. We're not kind of Egyptian death worshippers that are trying to do this for somebody else's case that they never even made themselves.
Well, you're not an Egyptian death worshipper, but I don't want to speak for all of our listeners who, you know, if you're an Egyptian death worshipper, if you want us to be Egyptian death worshippers, our hands are under the table. Just give us the money and we might do it.
If you're an Egyptian death worshipper, please be sure to follow and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Audio Boom. Also, send us an email about this. An angry email will be fine. I didn't have anything else. Is that a good place to lead off with disclosures?
Yeah, I've got no disclosures and nothing else.
I have nothing on GM. There are some things about it that I'm looking at, but don't own anything to disclose yet. And I have no relationship prior or future with Prince.
Okay, perfect. Talk to you guys next week.
Bye.